So Belise talked to you about balancing the risks of climate change against the costs of action. And what I want to start you thinking about is to focus on what kind of action we might take, and in particular on this kind of crazy idea that we might use fossil fuels without emitting carbon dioxide. And then in the latter part of my talk, to try and set that idea in context and talk about the trade-offs between that and other ways in which we might reduce our carbon dioxide emissions. So first, a few general words about the climate problem. You've heard some of this before, but I'll repeat. This is the sort of simplest schematic of what the climate problem is. Human actions change the climate. The climate system is in some ways responds, so this is forcing, this is climate response, and then climate impacts. When Arrhenius made those predictions, he actually got roughly the same kind of numbers we get now, a couple degrees centigrade temperature change for a doubling of CO2. But when he thought about the problem, he thought about it very, very differently. And in fact, he talked about a virtuous cycle in which increased use of fossil resources would drive up CO2 concentrations, and those increased CO2 concentrations would warm the climate, and that warming climate would help spread agriculture northward, feeding the growing human populations. So the core science that he had is, in a sense, much more similar to today's science than his way of thinking about it is, which is very different. Indeed, a contemporary of Arrhenius, Ekholm, talks seriously about digging up extra coal and burning it on the surface in order to accelerate this process. You might know both these guys were Swedes, or North Europeans anyway. So a central point here is that while there's been a lot of wonderful new modeling work, the core understanding of the fact that if we double, triple, or quadruple CO2 in the atmosphere, we'll see a big effect does not require the latest fancy computer models to understand. And in fact, the core science has been in our faces for a long time. The first major, serious, high-level report to a U.S. president was in 1965, long ago. And if you go back and read the Academy of Science reports from the late 70s, 77, they read in many ways very similarly to today's IPCC, except they're much better written and much shorter. So we have made a lot of scientific progress, but stepping back from the details of the current science, it's important to know that they're really the core link between great increases in CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere and climate change is not the crucially hard question. The crucially hard question is deciding how much we care about it, how much we care about its effects on humans and unmanaged ecosystems, and what we want to do about it. Of course, say one last thing about adaptation. People have mentioned this a little bit, but of course, if you're speaking purely about human welfare, then you can talk about balancing the risks and costs, where one of the things you might do as a response is adapt. But if you're a polar bear, you can't adapt. And that sounds a little flip, but in fact, the underlying idea is crucially important, that the extent to which we value the non-market damages of climate change, the non-market impacts of climate change, really are a key pivot around which climate policy turns. People often tend to ignore that. But in fact, if you honestly are thinking only about human impacts of climate change, you get quite a different answer from the standard answer most of us assume. So I want to move on and spend the next 15 minutes or so telling you about this crazy idea that you could use fossil fuels without CO2 emissions. And I'll first start technically, really telling you how you do it. And then I'll show you some pictures about what it looks like for real, because this is not just a laboratory idea by any means. And then finally, I'll tell you a bit about how it fits into the economic system and how it compares to other options. I often use this as a summary slide, but now I'll put it first. Despite the fact that this issue, that is the idea of using fossil fuels without CO2 emissions, which we often call CO2 capture and storage, despite the fact that this was basically not on the table a decade ago, nobody had thought about it. Not quite true, but almost true. It is doable. We can do it. The central thing I want to convince you of is that we can do it with technology we have today without any great technological innovation. Of course, technological innovation is central to bringing down the costs of doing it, but this is not some laboratory idea. The core bits we need to do this exist in the real economy at giant scale today. But you should be cautious. There's a long history of people like me, physicists, standing in front of you telling you that they have the magic solution to the energy problem of the day, and some of those solutions are now irrelevant. And so I have no way to tell whether this one will be relevant or not, although I do think I can say with confidence that it is doable. it's a general idea. Most of the research on this topic and most of the writing has focused on capturing CO2 emissions from electric power stations. And that might be the sort of big niche that is most tractable and most important. But there are, in fact, a bunch of earlier, easier niches in the economy where it's easier to capture CO2 emissions. And those early niches are central to starting a new technology on its road to widespread adoption. And so I want to stress what a general idea this is, that in fact is a general end-of-pipe solution kludge to the way we use fossil fuels in our economy. And so thinking about it in general, we're talking about a process where we extract fossil fuels, much as we do today, with all the attendant environmental impacts that fossil fuel extraction has. And I call it separate them. This is something that might look like a power plant or perhaps more like a modern chemical plant. It would take various inputs and produce airborne waste and waste to the ground. I'm not claiming this process would be perfectly clean. And it would produce zero or low carbon energy carriers, electricity or hydrogen. Electricity and hydrogen are what we call secondary energy sources or energy carriers. They don't exist in nature. They're things we make from primary energy, and we transport this primary energy, embody the secondary energy around the economy, and then use it in the form of all our electric slaves. Finally, the CO2 would be separated, and it would be put for storage either in the form of CO2 or perhaps as stable carbonates. If you want to do it at electric power plants, there are three rough methods you'd use. The first and sort of easiest to understand by analogy to the way we now control pollutants from electric power plants is post-combustion capture. So the idea here is that you could build a widget that captured CO2 from an electric power plant in much the same way as we already have widgets that capture sulfur and nitrogen, or especially sulfur, from electric power plants. This is completely doable. There are more than 20 such plants around the world today where CO2 is captured from combustion gases of electric power plants. And indeed, CO2 that's used for carbonation of beverages, Coca-Cola and whatnot, often comes from those sources. So this is a commercial technology today. And if you wanted to buy a CO2 capture system and add it onto an existing plant, you could buy it today from and get multiple bids from major engineering firms, and the cost would be high, but there's no doubt you could do it. It's a hard problem because you've got to capture CO2 from a relatively dilute stream. A coal-fired plant has about 10% or 12% CO2 in the exhaust stream. And the stream is dirty in various ways. It's dirty with all the pollutants we know about. It also contains oxygen, which is a problem for a bunch of the solvents you'd use to do this process. So as a chemical engineering process, it's very hard to capture CO2 from the exhaust streams. Another thing you can do is you can go upstream one step, and you can effectively separate the carbon from the energy content by taking a stream of fossil fuels. It's most easy to imagine this with a stream of natural gas, methane, and effectively separate out the CO2 and the hydrogen, producing a stream of CO2 and a stream of hydrogen, where all the energy, if you like, has been transferred to the hydrogen. If you do that, separating out the CO2 is comparatively easy, because in general you're separating the CO2 from a high concentration, high pressure gas stream, which from a chemical engineer's point of view is a much easier and cheaper thing to do. But of course you've got to already be in the business of making hydrogen. As I'll tell you in a minute, we actually are in the business of making hydrogen at giant scale in the economy today. So this is not some laboratory idea. Finally, if you wanted to, you could spend all your capital cost and your energy up front. And you could separate oxygen from the air, which is an expensive process, takes a lot of energy. Then you could burn your fuel in pure oxygen. And the results of that are basically carbon dioxide, water, and whatever other contaminants went along for the ride, such as sulfur oxides. And separating the CO2 out of that is very easy. You just condense away the water. Those are the three broad routes that people talk about for capturing CO2 at electric power plants. All are completely possible. They exist in various forms in the current economy, but all are sort of reasonably understood. But on the other hand, there's a great deal of possibility for driving down the cost of each of those processes. If you want to use fossil fuels without CO2 emissions, you've got to do two things. One is separate, and the other one is store or sequester or dispose, whatever word you like. And I'll talk about that next. These are some of the enabling technologies that are necessary to make all the stuff I just talked about happen. Let's talk now about where you'd put the CO2 if you got it. So if you managed to get concentrated CO2 streams from various parts of industrial society, you want to put them somewhere, let's talk about where they'd go. So first of all, the x-axis here is in 1,000 gigatons carbon. And to give you a sense of scale, this is the total consumption of fossil fuels to date in human history, round numbers. And this is the amount of fossil fuels that we have by, I think, a pretty reputable analysis from IASA that doesn't include some real long shots like methane hydrates. If you put those in, we have much more fossil fuels. So right away, you can see we have no conceivable shortage of fossil fuels. We have enough for many hundreds of years at two or three times today's burn rate. This is the atmospheric content of CO2 and the amount we've added by putting CO2 in. This box is a lot smaller than that box because most of the CO2 we've added in historical times has not remained in the atmosphere. It's gone into the oceans or elsewhere. These are some of the places people talk about putting the CO2. Abandoned oil and gas reservoirs, deep coal beds, or deep aquifers. And I'll tell you in a minute that those things aren't as different as they seem if you think about the geology and geochemistry. Finally, people talk about injecting CO2 directly in the oceans. Indeed, that's the scheme for which the word geoengineering was coined in 1977, the idea that we would capture CO2 from power plants and inject it into the ocean to accelerate this equilibration between atmospheric and oceanic CO2. These estimates of capacity here are really my own error bars, and this one goes up two or three more orders of magnitude. The total capacity for storing carbon in aquifer systems is very large. This is the key thing, the one most important takeaway message, is that what we're talking about is a bunch of parts that already effectively exist in a toolbox, and we're talking about assembling them in new ways to produce this new animal, an animal that produces carbon-free energy, electricity or hydrogen, with CO2 capture. But we're not assembling that animal from laboratory ideas, although a lot of laboratory ideas will be needed, but we're assembling it substantially from parts we already have in our toolbox. Here's some of the most important parts in the toolbox. First of all, gasification of solid fuels. This is a process by which you take some solid fuel, coal, or various other waste fuels, and you turn into a gas, a synthetic gas called syngas. This is an old process. Indeed, the reason natural gas is called natural gas is it replaced something called town gas that used to exist 100 years ago and still does in some places. In fact, that's part of what we've been running through the Beijing lines that somebody saw being built, not natural gas, in fact, a mixture. And that synthetic gas can be easily produced from coal and used. It's a mixture of CO and H2, and it can be made into natural gas directly. And we actually have about 60 gigawatts, the equivalent roughly of 30 or so largest scale electric power plants around the world today of gasification capacity. So it's something we know how to do pretty well, even though we don't do it for electric power production very much. And that's a number that's growing very fast. We make an enormous quantity of hydrogen. 1.5% may not seem like very much, but it really is enormous. 1.5% of the whole primary energy input to our economies goes into hydrogen. In fact, it's in Alberta substantially more than that and growing very fast. That hydrogen is obviously not used to make hydrogen-powered cars. You don't see it on the street. You may be unaware that we're making all this hydrogen. It's mostly not used as a fuel. It's used for two main purposes, making ammonia and various petrochemical processing purposes where we so-called upgrade heavy fuels to make lighter fuels and also to desulfurize oil. But we know how to make hydrogen at giant scale, and we know how to do it cheaply. In fact, the cost of hydrogen today from these giant hydrogen production plants is about exactly the same in energy units as the raw cost of crude oil. Slightly more. CO2 capture and aqueous amines, I mentioned. There's this technology for capturing CO2 out of flue gases that's widely used. And finally, maybe and most surprisingly, the transport of CO2 and its injection into deep geological formations. I think when I first wrote a paper that was touched on this topic about 10 years ago, I foolishly said that we didn't know much about moving CO2 around and putting it deep underground. And indeed, everybody who worked on this part of the problem thought we didn't know much, but we were fools. It turned out that people in the petroleum industry knew all about doing this, and they've been doing it for 30 years or so. And they have, and I'll show you a picture of one, pipelines that run for almost 1,000 kilometers and move megaton quantities of CO2 around and put it in holes a kilometer underground. And I'll tell you a little bit about how that's done. They, of course, don't do that for the purpose of avoiding CO2 emissions to the atmosphere. They do it because CO2 works like a solvent and extracts more oil from the ground. But all the technology for transporting and injecting it is exactly the same. Finally, there are integrated systems, and I'll tell you about these in the form of discussions, of pictures in the next few slides. First of all, here's just some statistics on this pipeline and some pictures of actually a friend of mine, but also this is interesting, a man, David Hawkins, who is one of the most senior environmentalists, who's starting to think really hard about this topic in the United States, took when he visited the pipeline in the Four Corners of New Mexico. Here is something a little closer to home. There is a huge CO2 pipeline that connects this facility, a facility that takes coal and makes synthetic natural gas in North Dakota called the Great Plains Gasification Facility. And in normal operation, that facility would produce about 5 kilotons a day or so of carbon dioxide, which we vented to the atmosphere. The reason is coal is a high carbon to energy ratio fuel, and natural gas is a low carbon to energy ratio fuel. So if you want to take one and make the other, you've got to make a lot of excess carbon, a lot of excess CO2, which goes into the air. A couple hundred kilometers north at Weyburn, well, Pan-Canadian now and Canada, had an old oil field that was reaching the end of its natural production, and they needed extra CO2 in order to increase the productivity of that oil field. And so about $1 billion was spent to build this pipeline and various compressor stations and so on to connect up those two facilities. And now we have essentially the whole story I told you in that first slide. We're taking a high carbon to energy ratio fuel in coal, and we're putting out a low carbon energy ratio fuel out natural gas, and we're capturing most of the CO2 and putting it deep underground. And if you asked the people running this facility to make hydrogen instead of natural gas, that would actually be easier for them. So this all exists at the scale equivalent to the largest power plants in energy terms. Here's the more famous example, and perhaps a more important example, because this example happened in response to a climate tax. So this is an example of catching CO2 and putting it underground for the explicit purpose of avoiding CO2 emissions to the atmosphere. This is offshore in Norway, where Statoil was going to exploit one of the largest natural gas fields in North Europe, I guess the largest at that time, which is about 10%, 9% CO2 by volume. And under normal circumstances, they would have taken that natural gas to shore, separated the CO2, vented it to the atmosphere, and sold the rest of the gas to the European pipeline network. But because Norway has a climate-motivated tax on offshore emissions of CO2, basically CO2 from their enormous oil and gas industry, Statoil built a new platform that strips the CO2 out of the natural gas offshore and injects it into a formation that it's about 1 kilometer beneath the North Sea. So this is the North Sea. This is 1 kilometer of rock. This is a formation where they're injecting the CO2. This is the place where they're getting the gas. And interestingly enough, you can actually see pictures of that gas underground. These are pictures taken by so-called seismic imaging that actually shows you the bubble of gas moving around underground. This is before they started in 1999, and the difference roughly shows you the actual bubble of CO2 moving around underground. These pictures may not look very exciting, but they're actually key to us beginning to assure ourselves we really can understand how CO2 moves underground. Now, a few more words about geologic storage. Standing where we're standing now, there are a couple kilometers of porous rock under your feet. That rock varies greatly in how permeable it is, but it's essentially all has porosity of 10% or so, very round numbers. And you can drill holes in it. The holes are cheap. They're cheap on the scale of power plants. And you can inject CO2 into those holes in a way that's not unlike water. That is, if you're injecting a megaton a year of water 2 kilometers underground, it's not that different from injecting a megaton a year of CO2 underground. That's an important analogy because I'll be telling you about how much other stuff we inject underground in a minute. You could, in principle, do all this injection in a single pipe from a large power plant. I just want to give you a sense of the scales. So as a sort of engineer and physicist, I wanted to put some scales on things, and so I've actually showed you the size of the pipe and the depths and the thickness of the formation you might be injecting into. This is just pulled out of my head. I mean, it's the same as a bunch of people's studies, but this doesn't represent any detailed study. But it gives you a rough number. CO2 that you inject must displace whatever else was there, and a bunch of risks flow from that displacement. These risks actually are completely independent of the fact you're injecting CO2. The risks would be the same if you were injecting deionized distilled water or, God forbid, even Scotch whiskey. You'd get the same risks. And the risks are something like ground heave, induced seismicity, making little earthquakes, contamination of drinking water. Even if you inject clean water, you can push brines around underground and then, in principle, contaminate a drinking water aquifer. All of these things actually have happened in the history of oil and gas production and injection of wastes. But it's my view that they're all pretty well controlled, and I want to show you some evidence to support that view. This gives you a look at the quantities of stuff stuff being a generic term here, that we inject underground in the U.S. I don't have figures for Canada. I think it's much, much smaller. The U.S. is the country that is most aggressive in injecting waste underground. But whether that was a good idea or not, we have a lot of experience with injecting waste underground. This is a log scale, so 10, 100, 1,000, and the values here are megatons a year. To set a scale, this is the CO2 emitted by all U.S. electric power generation. And let me tell you about some of these. So, for example, in the U.S., we inject 2.7 gigatons of oil field brines deep underground. In Florida alone, we inject about half a gigaton of processed surface wastewater a kilometer or so underground. We inject most of the U.S. hazardous waste a few kilometers underground, and that's a case that's very carefully regulated with a whole elaborate risk management framework, which may not work perfectly. In fact, I think it's got some problems, but which does actually force operators to make predictions about how the waste will migrate and where it will stay for 10,000 years, and there's a bunch of monitoring requirements and so on. We also put natural gas into storage. We don't just take natural gas out of the ground. Around Alberta, we mostly take it out of the ground, but on the other end of the pipeline networks, we do a lot of storing it. And in fact, here's the total quantity of natural gas. This is mostly an annual flux in and out every year. And this is what I mentioned before, the CO2 for enhanced oil recovery. So we have a fair amount of experience with injecting both solids, both water or aqueous solutions and gases deep underground. And that experience, in fact, means that with respect to some of these displacement risks, I think we can say with some confidence that while they're not zero, they're manageable. All right, that's sort of the end of the rough summary of how you would go about using fossil fuels without CO2 emissions and what the key risks might be. Now I want to push a little further, showing you how this idea is really just the tip of a bunch of even crazier sounding ideas, including the idea that we could capture CO2 directly from the air, and ideas that we could capture, immobilize the CO2 in the form of rocks, minerals, that are then completely immobile, and so reduce the risk of leakage to zero at a cost and at environmental damage at the surface. The only idea I want to tell you about in detail is this idea, which is essentially all those technologies I talked about before for using fossil fuels, producing hydrogen or CO2, hydrogen or electricity, and capturing the CO2. All those ideas also work if you start with biomass, that is, wood or crop residues or what have you. But if you do that, you get this magic 2-for-1. You actually supply a useful energy product, but at the same time, at the net, you transfer CO2 from the air and the surface biosphere to deep underground. You're essentially sucking CO2 out of the air, making a net negative emission. This is potentially a big idea. In effect, it actually almost doubles the amount of mitigation, the amount of effective reduction in net CO2 emissions that you get per unit of biomass you use. And if you think what people believe are the serious strategies for addressing the climate problem, one of the serious strategies, not one actually I believe in that much, but one of the serious strategies is large-scale use of biomass energy. So wind, solar, nuclear, and biomass are sort of the typical large-scale solutions other than CO2 capture. But now I'm telling you there are a bunch of ideas out there, including the idea of mixing these two. I'll skip this graph. Now I want to tell you a little bit about how this fits into the economics of so-called mitigation, of reducing CO2 emissions. First of all, I want to emphasize how much our current civilization really rests on, depends on, abundant fossil energy. In Britain, which is sort of the cradle of the global industrial revolution, Britain became dominantly crossed being 50% fossil fueled in 1700, a long time ago. And now fossil fuels account globally for over 85% of total primary energy and really are the root on which our civilization has been built. That is not to say it's not possible now to switch that primary energy source, because the total cost of primary energy in the economy is surprisingly small. Well, I'm talking, you can have a look at this. This is from 1850 till roughly now. In some units, you can more or less forget about the total global consumption of what we call primary energy, so coal, gas, oil, hydropower, nuclear, and biomass. And you can see the enormous increase since 1950. We're talking, first of all, about a very great quantity of CO2. It's hard to emphasize how much material we're talking about, not just a lot of energy, but a lot of material. To bring it down to individual terms, we're each responsible, on average, for something like 20 tons of CO2 emissions per year per person. So if I liquefy the CO2, as we have to do to inject it deep underground, and I make it roughly as dense as water, so it's a high-pressure liquid that is sort of like water, we're talking about each of us being responsible for a cube of it about twice my height on a side. Really a lot of materials, one of the largest materials flows in our society. So people in the chemical industry have taught us very thoughtfully over the last few decades that in general we should avoid these end-of-pipe solutions and think about designing industrial processes to do reuse and to avoid the production of wastes. And so this solution is certainly, in a way, very unelegant. It is not doing that. But it's important to realize what a large quantity it is. It vastly dwarfs all other manufactured products, the production of CO2. In the next few slides, I'll be telling you about these estimates of the cost of reducing CO2 and emissions and the predictions of how that cost changes if we have carbon dioxide capture and storage. But I want to make you cautious. We have essentially no proven ability to predict technological change with anything like confidence over 100-year time periods. And while there's a whole industry of people building coupled models that purport to show how the economy operates and what the cost of reducing CO2 emissions is on 100-year timescales, and while it's important work, and I've been part of it, I think you have to have some humility and realize just how bad we are at doing that. And I want to show you an important example that's, I think, important in thinking about capacities and certainly important to people in this town. This is the oil price history, really, since inception, since 1859, just near Pittsburgh, in fact, when the oil age started. And for effectively the whole time until the oil shock, oil always cost $10 a barrel U.S. in current units, which is a just stunning fact. And now it costs twice that or three times that, big deal. But, I mean, big deal from a long 100-year viewpoint. And during that time, we continuously thought we'd run out. The first serious predictions of running out of oil were in Pittsburgh in the 1880s when they were really running short of production in the oil regions. They couldn't imagine anywhere else that oil could be produced because they only knew about one kind of technology and one kind of formation for producing oil. There is a systematic reason why we have continuously underestimated the size of the resource, why we've consistently assumed we've run out of oil sooner than we really have. And that single reason is technological change. That estimates of the amount that's there are in fact not estimates just of a fact about nature as they seem to be. They're also implicitly estimates about our technology for recovering that stuff from the ground. The same is precisely true for putting it back in. And those estimates therefore hang on how technology evolves over the next 100 years and on how that technological evolution changes because of climate policy. Technology does respond to policy, and in particular, it does respond to environmental control policy or pollution control policy. Here's perhaps the most important example that's sort of in the air pollution business. The cost of scrubbing sulfur out of coal-fired power plants, the capital cost of the sulfur scrubbers, has declined roughly by a factor of 2 in 20 years since the American Clean Air Act started. This is an example of technological change, including patenting and a whole industry that sprang up purely because of an environmental regulation. Nobody would have been building sulfur scrubbers but for that. So we should have humility, and we should know that these estimates depend on predictions of technological change that we are very poor at making. Nonetheless, here are some estimates. This is an old slide, but I like it, in fact, because it shows two wildly different answers. So let me tell you what's shown here. This is the next 100 years on the bottom axis, and this is of the what we call a carbon price, an economic model on the y-axis. This is dollars per ton carbon, and you can think of this as the carbon tax you would have to impose to get a certain result. And the result is, in both the cases, both these models are trying to stabilize CO2 emissions at something like 500 parts per million or 550 parts per million. And you can look at the black lines in both models are the predicted costs of carbon for that stabilization. And first of all, you should see how wildly different these black lines are. And these lines are produced by people who know each other well, who are sort of part of a small clique of bottlers who build these things, who understand the workings of each other's models, and who don't, you know, wildly disagree. Neither of the people who produce these two models are fools. They're just completely different. They've used different assumptions that are all plausible assumptions and got very different answers. And that's really an important fact. That's why I picked these two extreme cases. I also want you to think about how big this number is. $1,000 a ton carbon is a big number. It is not true that stabilizing CO2 emissions is going to break the economy. The sort of mean standard estimate for the cost of stabilizing CO2 emissions is something like a couple percent of GDP reduction over the century. But nonetheless, if you believe these standard answers, you get a very high number. To think about it, I'm afraid I know these numbers better for the U.S. economy, so I'm going to quote them that way. The U.S. emits about a gigaton and a half of carbon a year, so $100 a ton carbon tax would be $150 billion. It's a lot of money. And $1,000 a ton carbon tax would be enormous. And, of course, the red curves, as you can see, are how it looks with a very primitive version of carbon dioxide capture in the models. We have no idea whether it's right. The reason that in this model it goes down is because of the way technological learning or technological change is included in that model. I have no idea whether it's right. I guess what I haven't said before I go to the last two slides is roughly what we do know in the short term. We know that if you were going to build a new power plant that supplied what we call baseload electricity, that is electricity, a power plant that runs most of the time, not one that supplies the peaks of the electric load, if you're going to build a new power plant over maybe the next 15 years or so, the additional cost in cents per kilowatt hour at the power plant gate, not the cost you pay, but the additional cost at the power plant gate, would be something like a U.S. cent or two per kilowatt hour. That's an increase in the cost of electricity of about 50%, because the cost of making electricity now is about 3 cents a kilowatt hour, round numbers. The increase that you'd see at your meter is quite a bit smaller, because you see all these additional costs of transportation, distribution, and what have you as well. So that's a rough summary on costs. Now I want to step back one more step and talk a little bit about the trade-offs and try and say something about what this all means. First of all, you've got to admit, this is an inelegant end-of-pipe solution, a technical fix, a kludge. In fact, I said that to 500 of my colleagues in this business who met at the annual meeting we have every 2 years in the Grand Conference Hall in Kyoto, where the Kyoto Conference was negotiated just a month ago. And I got a lot of unhappy looks. But we have to admit it's true. But we have no easy options. If we want to preserve the option to avoid substantial climate change, which I think means preserving the option to keep CO2 concentrations below about 450, which many people in the scientific community who you heard earlier will tell you is an impossible goal, but on the other hand, they're telling you that partly or a very unlikely to be achieved goal. They're telling you that perhaps because they're more realistic and I'm optimistic, but also because that's based on the sort of standard consensus estimates of the costs of control, which are based on a roughly static picture of technological costs over time, which I believe is false, although we don't know what the right answer is. Absent CO2 capture and storage, sorry, I'm using different acronyms in this talk, our options are roughly renewables or nuclear. And in the last few decades of thinking about this, partisans of both sides have been sort of free to imagine that the world would eventually knock on their door because there were no other options. And partisans of both sides have sort of felt that the people on the other sides were, I don't know how to put it politely, were not realistic. And so there's been little serious comparative analysis of the risks and the social impacts and social implications of either choice, a renewable or nuclear choice. I think we have to remember that cost is not the only issue by any means. So as well as talking about the costs of mitigating climate change as compared to the climate impacts, we need to talk seriously about the effects, social, technological risks, what have you, of different large-scale energy system choices that we might make as ways to reduce CO2 emissions, because each of these choices has substantial risks and substantial social implications. So, for example, large-scale use of biomass would result in a substantial increase of the human footprint on the land and large environmental impacts, I believe, on the scale of the environmental impacts we're trying to solve. Large-scale use of wind would have other impacts. There are no energy technologies at the scale at which we now use energy that will not produce significant impacts. An exciting thing about having this new option on the table, I believe, is it really broadens our options, gives us a sense that there was more there than just renewables and nuclear, and I hope makes us think more seriously about the trade-offs between those various options. Finally, I can't overemphasize what a fundamental change this is in our thinking about the future of fossil fuels. When I first was interested in energy topics in high school in 79 or so, I think I first wrote essays on energy stuff in grade 13, and that marks me as an Ontarian. I read and I believed what my elders and betters told me, which was that we'd run out of fossil fuels by about now, by 2000 or so. And those of us who thought seriously about the climate problem over the last decade or decades assumed that the future of fossil fuels was short because there was an unbreakable link between using the fossil energy reserves deep underground and transferring that fossil carbon to the atmosphere and therefore impacting the climate. I think we can now say that both of those things are false. It is, in fact, possible to use fossil fuels for 100 years or more in the future, really the foreseeable future, without emitting CO2 at large scale. This is definitely not risk-free. It definitely is not the only answer, nor should it be the only answer. I don't even think we know enough about it yet to want to commit to it at giant scale. But we do know enough to know that it is a serious possibility, and therefore a really different view of the energy future than we had before. And that's a really fundamental change in our thinking about energy futures. And that fundamental change, I think, will take a long time, lifetimes, to sink in. It changes the politics, potentially radically. The reason is, up till now, the fossil fuel industries and fossil-dependent nations and provinces have tended to see themselves as natural losers under climate policy, and so have attempted to block climate policy, sometimes by exaggerating the uncertainty in the science or exaggerating the cost of control. To the extent that this is part of what we do, and to the extent that the existing folks who run the global fossil, control the global fossil business, are able to partly control the business of using fossil fuels without CO2 emissions, they stand to perhaps even gain or certainly lose much less, because effectively they get to charge us twice, both for taking it out of the ground and then again for putting it into the ground. And this really substantially changes the way things look from the top of the global oil business, and I know this from talking to some such folks. It's a wedge issue for the environmental community. On the one hand, many people have spent their lives fighting fossil fuels as kind of the root problem. And so the idea that we should get to a solution which still involves fossil fuels strikes many people as automatically wrong on its face. But others, and I mean serious folks in the environmental community, now take this very seriously because they believe it's one of the few options we have if you want to really move aggressively and preserve an option like stabilizing it under a CO2 doubling. Maybe I'll end right there, actually. Also, I'll add one more note in response to Murray's comment about slaves, which I thought was very nice in a way. I guess my view is that we don't have to abolish the slaves. And incidentally, I can tell you how many we each have. The number is about 30. So slaves, people use about a couple hundred watts, and we each are responsible for about 10 kilowatts of primary energy. So about 30 slaves is the total amount of energy power we have in this modern civilization. It's a stunning amount of power. But I think the answer is, while there may be cogent reasons why we should consume less, why we should have less slaves, I believe, in fact, it's technologically possible, not risk-free, but possible, to deal with this problem at a cost of not eliminating slaves, but increasing their cost by a few percent in the long run.